And of course, Eldon Taylor with us. We're talking about his modified new book, Choices and Illusions. It was a bestseller. It probably will be again. We'll be back in a moment as we talk choices, your questions, and your stories. What choices would you change? Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, how did you get interested in the mind in the first place?
Yeah. You know, I think I was wired that way. That is one thing I was born with. I can tell you this. When I was very young, I don't know how old, you know, off the top of my head, I would say I must have been somewhere around 7 or 8 years of age. A neighbor lady that used to come over and have coffee with my mother split with her husband. And she happened to be telling my mother all about it. And I was sitting there. And I knew she was lying. I knew she was making up. Now, I can't tell you how I know. I just knew. And I blurted out of my mouth something like, you know, that's not true. I got in huge trouble over that. But, you know, I when I look back on my life, I know that since at least that time, I've always been fascinated by why people do what they do. You know, George, in the years that I ran lie detection tests, I had people confess to, you know, crimes that are going to put them away for a very, very long time. And while you know what the techniques are that you ply a person with to get them to tell you the truth and confess, at the same time, you know, I'm hitting myself in the back of the head thinking, why on earth would someone admit to that? I mean, So I, you know, come full forward. Why we do what we do seems to me to be the one thing that I was absolutely hardwired in this lifetime to look into.
I like that. Good for you.
Well, thank you, sir.
Let's take some calls. We've got many here. Renee is in Rocky River, Ohio. Go ahead, Renee. Question or a choice you wish you changed?
Well, actually, I wanted to share an incident that happened where I first learned how easy it is to program or influence people with your word choices. It was something that happened way back in when I was a senior in high school in an honors English class. So all of the students were, you know, America's best and brightest, and everyone concentrating on getting into the college of their choice, making the right choices. The teacher put us in a circle, and she asked a question. Her exact words were, do you think that people think in terms of black and white? And she made it so that I was the last one to answer. Every single person went around the room, and they either said, yes, yes, definitely yes, and here's my well-thought-out reason why that's true, or no, no, definitely no, and here's why. And then finally, when it got to me, I figured I deserved a little arrogance. I said, you know, thanks for making my job so easy, but how about maybe? You know, nobody considered that, you know, maybe would be an answer. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, it all depends. So that really, you know, drove it home to me how, you know, how eager people were to do the right thing, you know, just based on how the question was presented to them.
That's right. That's a very good story, Renee. Very good story.
Eldon, what are people going to do over the next year or two when they're faced with incredible pressures, not caused by them, but by government and politicians and elected officials?
You know, George, I get asked that a lot, and I'm going to give you the, you know, the quick canned answer. If you think about a pressure cooker, the kind that your mother used to can fruit and vegetables in, put up in the old jars in the cupboard, the heat's been turned up, and, you know, the pressure is really on. And what's going to happen is a lot of people are just unable to handle that pressure. We are seeing that take place right now. We're seeing some really unusually cruel behavior person to person. And I think that the acceleration in violence, the acceleration in dis-ease, psychological and physical, both in their nature, are symptoms of what's going on in our society. They're absolute symptoms of a society that has become more and more alienated from itself. And unfortunately, things like what's going, you know, I mean, the government shutdown right now is creating a lot of pressure, a lot of anxiety because of the uncertainty that's attached to it. People don't generally do well with uncertainty. That's not something that we like. You know, it takes a rare personality to like the idea that maybe the parachute will open and maybe it won't. We much prefer to think that, well, of course it's going to open. It only rarely wouldn't ever, you know? And then I have a backup chute. When we live at a time where tomorrow there could be a dirty bomb, tomorrow there could be a school shooting, the government is shut down, the political parties have never been further apart.
Anything could happen.
All of this stuff that is going on right now, not just in this country, too, but abroad. And then we add, it is a 24/7 news cycle. And there are so many people that are just plugged into that. And I guess I'm going to add this, too. You know, if you're not in front of the news, instead of being in front of George Neary like you should be, too many people are in front of television. And unfortunately, what we're seeing people utilize as their form of entertainment is more violence and more sex. And all of that, you know, predisposes our behavior. You know, one of the things that I found really interesting is an experiment I did a few years ago. I had triple bypass surgery, and when I came back from the surgery, I wanted to get right back to playing with my horses and doing the thing.
Takes a little while, they tell me.
Yeah, I wanted the fastest possible recovery, though. I'm not going to be slow about this. And so, you know, having the knowledge that I have and some of the friends I have, I was able to lay equipment in. And one of the things that I had was a device that monitored my heart rate activity, not just the beats of my heart, but and the regularity, but the rhythm itself.
Was there a concern?
Well, not with my heart. I mean, the reason I had triple bypass was I had what they call a widowmaker. I had two mains completely blocked.
Wow.
And one that was 99%, but it was apparently it's due to cholesterol and a genetic factor and
calcium, you know, buildup, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, I ate all the wrong kinds of things at that time, too. So, you know, I had my own responsibility in this. I'm not blaming it on someone else. Nevertheless, here was the thing. While I looked at this equipment, I watch it every evening. I would do things mentally to find that optimal place of my breathing or my mentation where I was promoting heart health. Well, there's a game that I like to play, and you know, I couldn't get up and do a lot of things all day long. We're talking, this is the maybe month two after the surgery, and this game is called Civilization. It's Sid Meier's computer game, Civilization. So I would play this game because it's a strategy game like chess, but there's no way to play the game and not be in battle with somebody over some resource, some other nation. The computer's going to have them attack you, and you're building armies, and it's simulating a real government. What I found was if I played that game and a war came, I could not keep my heart in a rhythmic pattern. Hmm. I discovered over a 30-day period that whenever I held an angry thought, whenever I held a grudging thought, whenever I thought about blame or I felt sorry for myself, all of those kinds of thoughts, they cause everything from arrhythmias to this discordant beating pattern. When I remained focused on the positive, then my heart responded. So to me, that was a real awakening. You know, I spent all this time in my head, studying my head and everybody else's and why we do what we do. And I paid very little attention to my heart. But what I did learn is that there is a direct connection here, and all of this animus that we see, all of this uncertainty, all of this violence, all of this hostility, all of this aggression that's going on in the world, this pressure cooker that I mentioned, what it does is it literally damages our being. It literally, you know, Martin, I'm trying to think of heart math, would tell you that you cannot maintain a healthy heart while you're a healthy heart pattern, I should say, while you're imbibing in that kind of content.
True. Plus, you have to be happy.
Yeah, that's right. You know, listen, happiness is what success is, to me, at least. I'll flash back to the prison system. Hey, I had the brand new Lincoln Mark V, you know, with a big moonroof, paid for, title in my safe to deposit box. I had the fancy horses, the trucks and the trailers, you know, with the campers on them. I had all the accoutrements that you would think would make a person happy. But I was the most miserable person on the planet. I was paranoid. I never drove home the same way. You know, two nights in a row, I'm always looking over my shoulder, checking my mirror, you know. I had friends that told me you change women like most men change shirts. And it wasn't because I wanted to. It was because they changed me. You know, I was kind of a mess. But when I made this little epiphany at the prison system, about the forgiveness, and I decided, you know, I'm going to change my life. I am going to find a quality of life. I'm going to begin to maybe walk a talk. I mean, I'm going to use this technology that I've just, you know, come up with here that we patented and all that, but I'm going to use this technology on myself. And what else can I do? Then I started doing things proactively. For example, I saw a counselor. And a marvelous one that was, you know, she taught meditation and things of that nature. And she said to me, she said, Eldon, if you want to change, you're going to have to give up things. You have to understand that. In order to change, you have to give up some things. And this mentation process that you have where you see people in church that you're going to, you know, maybe arrest the next day, and so you don't go to church. This process of this paranoia, this all these thoughts that you have about, you know, evil people in the world and the bad things that can happen, and what you're going to have to do is just change that storyline. You're going to have to realize that everything that happens to you for some good. Connie, that doesn't even make any sense. You can't talk me into believing that. But she said, well, look at it this way. It's happened. What are you going to do about it? You can be proactive, or you can whimper and be a victim. Now, if you're going to be proactive, well, then why not look at it and say there's going to be some good come from this? Because just pragmatically, that changes your focus and gives you an opportunity maybe to find some good in it as opposed to react to it. Well, okay, all right. I can see the practical side of that. I guess I can try that. I left her office. I went back to my office. George, my office was in a strip mall. It was a horseshoe-shaped strip mall.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And in the middle of that horseshoe was a restaurant. And you pulled past that restaurant as you pulled in toward my office, which was at the top of the horseshoe. And as I pulled in my brand-new Cadillac, this fellow sitting, he was parked in front of the restaurant, and an old clunker comes backing out and slams the side of my car.
Ugh.
Hey?
Hate that.
Now, you know, if I hadn't have just left her, I know that I would have gotten out of the car really angry, upset. You know, the adrenaline would have poured on, the catecholamines. I would have shut down the optimal operation of my endocrine, immune, and ANS, autonomic nervous system, et cetera, and so forth. But instead, I thought of what she said, and I can't wait to see what good comes from this. Those were her words. Next time something bad happens to you, say to yourself, I can't wait to see what good comes from this. Just try it out. So I said that to myself. I got out of my car, now a little calmer than I might have been, and this elderly gentleman was wagging a finger at me, accusing me of hiding behind his car so he could back into me. Now, he had this old clunker of a jalopy. Now, it just so happened that there were two police officers that were coming out of the restaurant. They saw it. I ended up in the car with one of them, and we just roared. We just laughed. Now, I look back on that today. You know, the car got fixed. That insurance took care of all that. Bottom line is, had I reacted differently, well, that entire event could have been very poisonous, and who knows what it might have
happened. Well, and we've seen some of those things happen.
Yeah, but I didn't. Instead, now when I look back on it, I laugh, and it becomes a tutorial to myself, and I hope to many people that I've shared this story with, because sometimes bad things happen, but just because a bad thing happens doesn't mean that it takes control of your life, that it needs to dominate your thoughts, that you need to get even, that you need to respond to it.
So you're not a road rager?
No. For sure.
Let's take some more calls. Anita's in New York. Hi, Anita. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Excellent program, including both parts, George. I have my usual brief comment and three-parter. The comment concerns what Goebel said about how it's easier to get the population to believe a big lie, such as 9/11/01. So my question concerns, because we seem to be things happening on a foundational lie, the impossible couldn't have happened. Yet I'd like him to reflect on how do we deal in terms of his knowledge and technology with the foundational lies that keep piling up. Seymour Hersh came out and says that Obama was not killed in that 2011 raid. That was another big lie.
You mean bin Laden?
In Obama, but
you mean bin Laden?
Let me just, Elton, let me just finish, and then it's easier to hear you over the air. The second part deals with our future, because obviously the public is in a mind trance, pretty much doesn't understand about the importance of their rights or just rule of law. And the last part of the question deals with, if you had a choice between government not using any type of mind technologies, and there's a lot of them out there now with these frequency things going on, and they're doing a positive, in other words, positively affecting or tweeting the population's critical understandings. And I'll listen to the air if you understand my three questions.
All right. Remember those three questions, Eldon, because we're going to take a little break and come right back, okay? Eldon Taylor with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back. On our next Coast to Coast program, James Carman joins us. He's a paranormal investigator. He'll be talking about some reverse alien technology and also the human-alien hybrid program. Make sure you're part of that. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, you remember those three questions?
I think so.
All right.
You know, you kind of caught me there, I'll admit that. But I think we've got them down here. Anita's first question or comment had to do with what she called foundational or big lies. You know, she used 9/11 as one of those. And I don't want to go there. I'm going to answer that factually. First of all, you're absolutely right, Anita. There are big lies. There are big lies that we have uncovered, that we know about, that are not, you know, in any way, shape, or form, arguably attenuated by conspiracy theories. They are factual. For example, the Creole folks, an advertising agency, told lies like children were being bayoneted by German soldiers to embroil the rage and passion of the American people. Okay, that worked. But now, if you flash forward, it not only worked, it set a precedent. In October of 1990, a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl identified only as Naraya appeared in Washington before the House of Representatives Human Rights Caucus. Mm-hmm. She testified that Iraqi soldiers who had invaded Kuwait on August 2nd, tore hundreds of babies from hospital incubators and killed them. Television flashed her testimony around the world. Remember it, George?
Yep, it was a lie.
It was a total lie. Bush quoted it over and over and over. 6 times in 1 month, he referred to 312 premature babies at Kuwait City's maternity hospital who died after Iraqi soldiers stole their incubators and left the infants on the floor. Close quote. So big lies, absolutely. Was the big lie in this instance the drum up for the war in Iraq, the first war? Absolutely. No doubt about it. Okay. What do we do then if we know that there are foundational lies that are going on? Well, you know, what we have to do is become a little more suspicious. We have to look at history. I believe that if you don't look at history, history will repeat itself. And our failure to look at it ensures that it will repeat itself. And so I think what we have to do is become more informed, become wiser about all of this rhetoric that we hear. I don't know what happened in Syria for sure. I don't think anybody does that is willing to step forward and give us the evidence. Which side did what? That was a red line. A red line was drawn. We were going to, and then it's all just kind of disappeared. It's all kind of gone away. When it's all said and done, it may be 10 years down the highway before we ever learn what happened, if we learn what happened at all. But we should know from earlier stories that we don't want to get too awful excited about these stories. We don't want to rush up there and say, oh, my God, we need to do something about this. We need to at least spend sufficient time to thoroughly investigate, validate the stories that are coming forward. So, unfortunately, I think we live at a time when we have to be somewhat of a political activist. We have to pay attention to all the stories that are coming out from both sides, from all sides, and exercise caution, not just react. And that goes also the other way. We don't want to run off and say, oh, yeah, I heard this story about this. It's just another lie. We want to be cautious about that, too, because, you know, we can be just as guilty in one direction as they can be in another direction.
It was a huge public relations campaign.
Well,
mastermind by a company here in this country.
That's right.
And the little girl ended up being the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United Nations.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. That is a big signal. And I hope you understand that, Anita, that it is a very solid question. It is a very good question, and it deserves, you know, our attention. But, you know, we also want to be cautious that we don't go too far the other way.
That's right.
And begin to see everything as a lie.
Let us go to the phones again. Jeffrey, truck driving in Texas. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, Eldon.
Hi.
Your book, Choices and Illusions, sounds like something I might read, but my girlfriend and I are having problems, and it's like this material would be great for both of us, but the forgiving letting go, I'm wondering, is that embed an audio file you can download?
Any
other material you could advise or suggest for like a daily program thereafter?
Sure. You know, Jeff, if you go to my website, eldontaylor.com,
E-L-D-O-N,
there is a link that takes you to free programs, and there you can download the Forgiving program. It's free. Now, if you get the book, Choices and Illusions, and right now if you get the book, you get all kinds of free gifts with it because there's a number of luminaries that like the material that's in the book that are sponsoring it. And so there are all kinds of gifts. And you'll see that banner at my page as well. If you get the book, it comes with an InnerTalk CD, Unlimited Personal Power. And that CD is all about building self-esteem, the kind of self-esteem that, you know, for all intent and purposes, is what you want in a relationship. It is the from the inside out, your ability to share with integrity between the two of you. So I would think that that would be, you know, an outstanding program to work with. And the book, Jeff, does take you systematically through how do I uncover these thoughts that I have? How do I get rid of these aberrant thoughts? You know, maybe, you know, I have thoughts of jealousy, or maybe I have anger issues, or maybe I have abandonment issues. All of the kinds of, and we didn't really get a chance to talk about that, but all of the kinds of defense mechanisms that we can end up with as strategies in our adult life that fail to serve us today, that might have protected us when we first developed them as small children in order to avoid being rejected, in order to find ourselves being accepted, and so forth. It, uncovering those things, finding those things, that can be very freeing. So there's very definite tool set that's in the book that takes you systematically through how you uncover the material, how you become proactive about the material, and how you can make what I think is the largest change you'll ever make in your life. And that's convolute the entire model. I could tell you very quickly that when I had this criminalistics practice and was so successful on the outside, Jeff, but nothing worked in my life and I was angry and bitter, that the only thing that I had in mind was more. You know, I just wanted more.
More.
I wanted more money. I wanted more time. I wanted more power. I wanted more clients. I just wanted more, more, more. And it was that attitude that I discovered was, you know, undercutting my efforts at finding happiness in life. When I convoluted the model, when I turned it around and decided, you know, I'm going to practice what I preach, and let me give this one real quick. Like, I had a woman referred to me by a psychiatrist who was suicidal, and when she first came into my office, I looked at her intake sheets, and I saw that her first health care provider was a man I thought walked on water, Milton Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to myself, you know, what are you possibly going to do with this woman? And, you know, I suppose serendipity, synchronicity, something visited me, and I decided that I would convolute her model. Looking at her sheets, you know, she had a lot of guilt and very low self-esteem, and you could understand why she had it, but understanding it wasn't sufficient to change her valuation of herself, Jeff. So what I had her do as a part and parcel of her treatment protocol, which was a 10-week brief therapy, was she had homework. And that first week she had to do one good deed every day for someone. Go out of her way to do a good deed. Didn't have to be a monumental thing, but one. And she wrote it in her diary at the end of the day just before she fell asleep. At that time, she was to look at it, think about how that made the other person feel and how it made her feel. And then go ahead and go to sleep. Week two, it was two. We kept that up to week five, where it became five a day. And that's how it remained for the finish. Now, I'm going to tell you that by the end of this 10 weeks, this woman was off of most of the pharmacology, and I followed her. It changed her life. What happens when you begin to give to other people is you begin to find the merit in your life. Your life begins to have value. Independent value. You made a difference to some other human being. You know, and I tell people this, I talk to business people all the time. If you're a plumber, if you're a lawyer, if you're an electrician, it doesn't matter what you do. You're a truck driver, Jeff. If what you do to serve your client, you do it to the best of your ability. You're helping that person. That's the attitude you take to everything that you do. It's no longer just a job. It's not just about how much money I'm going to make. If that's what you do, and you do it with the purpose of serving that person, I tell you, two things happen. The first one is you feel a whole lot better about what you do. The second one is you recognize your value, but the inverse proportion of that is also true. Your clients, your customers recognize your value, and you find that your business process prospers as a result. I hope that makes some success or some sense, Jeff, but it's as true of relationships, one-on-one personal relationships, as it is of any other aspect of your life.
All right, back to a couple more calls. We go to Gordon in Frankfort, Kentucky, first-time caller. Gordon, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Norrie.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
George, I'm only 20, and I listen to your program a lot, and I gain a lot of wisdom from it, and even a few witty quotes I get to use.
I say they are all
so
yours.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Eldon, what I have is a situation, and what I would like from you is your take on it and what you think I should do from here. It's a choice that I'm getting ready to have to make. It's on a smaller scale, I believe. When it comes to the human experience, even the smaller things matter just as much as the big things. But I'm in an argument with one of my friends, and this argument started as a debate between a certain genre of music, as trivial as it seems, a certain genre of music, whether or not it is good music. And what it has evolved into is a pretty much who has the most, validity in their position, wit, and who's best with wordplay. You know, the kind of guy this guy is he'll start pointing out grammatical errors and different things like that, something known as institutionalization and projectionism. It's like an argumentative defense mechanism, and it just goes on, and it's not even about the music thing anymore, and it's become public. It's been, you know, in person. It's been, you know, on social media and whatnot. And I've seen this guy do this before, argue with other people, and he's like a brother to me. And I'm just wondering if I should, you know, just make a big move to call him out and do what I can to try to put him in his place, because that's honestly what I believe he needs. Or I always consider the latter option. Should I submit, apologize, and see what good will come out of it?
What do you think, Elton, just a few minutes ago? All right, thank you.
Well, you know, Gordon, you've got more than just those two choices, first of all. I mean, but if I'm only going to look at those two choices, I'm going to ask you a question. What is it that you're going to gain if you attack him, except more combativeness? And let's assume that you win. And you make your point. You have described a personality that is very definitely going to try to get back at you. You say he's like a brother, but it also sounds like you want to punish him, and that will only alienate him. So, you know, what I have to say here, Gordon, is what's the end objective? What is it you would like most as a result of your relationship with this person? If it is to, as you say, put him in his place, is that your place to do it? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is a kind of a contest that you can't win. You could pull the information out of research studies after research study, and you could put the studies in front of him. You could show him maybe that the music that he'd chosen caused chickens to stop laying eggs and cows to quit giving milk. There are all kinds of studies on the influence of music, and you can Google them. You can pull them off on your computer. But that just prolongs the argument. It would seem to me that, you know, there's at least a third alternative here, and the third alternative is to acquiesce your way away from it. If the relationship is more important to you than the argument, then, putting your arm around the guy and saying, if you have to have it that way, it's okay with me. And letting it go is probably the most proactive thing that you can do.
Eldon, just a few more minutes left here. If people want more information on what you do, let's guide them to you.
Sure. Thank you very much, George. Go to my website, Eldon Taylor, that's ELDONTAYLOR.com. The book that we've been talking about, Choices and Illusions, is its book launch was today, its official launch. It, as I said, has that free CD in it and all kinds of gifts. But if you go to the page and look at the page, then it'll tell you all about it. I'm not really good at that kind of thing, so I'll let the page sell that. The free program that I told you about is also there. I believe that that's where we all should start. That's why that program is free. And I would encourage everybody to go get it and download the program and begin to work with it. You know, the proof is in the pudding. We change our life one thought at a time, just like we make the longest journey one step at a time. And the only thing that's going to change your mind, the only thing that's going to give you the power to change your mind is in your mind. And that's what we have to be aware of.
Eldon, my friend, always be well, okay?
Hey, you too. Thank you so very much, George. I love you, and I love your show, and you know that.
I know you do, my friend, and we care about you too greatly. Eldon Taylor, as we talked about choices. And, you know, you think back at all the things you've done in your life, the choices you've picked, the things you wish you could change. And, boy, I wish I could have changed a lot, but you can't. That's the funny part about it. Life moves on, and you got to make the best of it. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Shad Landesur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.